good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan, and joining me in studio I have consultant paediatric psychiatrist Dr. Kieran Moore, Dr. Harry Barry, GP specialising in mental health and the author of a number of books in this field, James Brown, Fianna Fáil TD for Wexford and party spokesperson on mental health, Mark Ward, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest, and medical journalist June Shannon. We want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @LateDebateRTE, #RTELD. Now, before we go to our expert panel and that discussion on mental health services, we'll just have a quick catch-up on the political developments of the day. I'm joined on the line now by RTE's political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. Paul, the time frame for electing our next Taoiseach seems to be stretching ever further away from us.
Yeah, that's the way it seemed earlier on today. We had a meeting of the Doyle's Business Committee, which basically orders the business that's going to take place in the House on the next day. The House is going to meet this Thursday week on March the 5th. And they decided that not enough progress had been made on government formation. Therefore, it would be futile to hold a vote. And on that basis, while the Doyle will meet and the 160 TDs will be there and they hear stuff about the European Council, there will not be a vote on who should be the next Taoiseach. And that sort of seemed to depress things. I believe from Sinn Féin sources that Angus O'Snodhig, who is on the business committee, had proposed that there would be a vote. However, he didn't receive support from the other groups and other members on that committee, and on that basis, no vote was going to take place. So, you know, coming up to 6 o'clock this evening, it seemed to be reflective of the position that while there were lots of talks going on between the parties, the Rural Independents were meeting Fianna Fáil today, Sinn Féin was meeting the Soc Dems, that they weren't necessarily going very far. The one point where things did seem to have moved on was Fianna Fáil. They were having talks with the Green Party between 9:30 and 5 p.m. today, same again tomorrow, and that the Fianna Fáil team involved 15 people. So that seemed to have moved beyond the question of exploratory talks. That seemed to be moving into more substantial talks.
And of course, that news again this evening that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have agreed to hold an open day policy exchange. Have I got that right?
That's right, a one-day policy exchange. And that had been something which Micheál Martin had suggested yesterday after his meeting with Leo Varadkar, that that would be helpful, even on an exploratory basis, that they would begin to talk about policy. And if you remember, Leo Varadkar at that particular time was saying that his position hadn't changed. He was leading his party into opposition. It was up to other parties, therefore, to, you know, like Sinn Féin, like Fianna Fáil, that they had the greatest first preference votes, they had the greatest number of seats. The obligation was on them to try and do something, but he seems to have rode back on that. We now do have this one-day policy between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, this one-day policy exchange. They are going to talk about issues like housing, health, cost of living, the economy and tax. And in a Fianna Fáil spokesman said afterwards that, you know, serious work now needs to be done. So that seemed to give the day a bit more momentum. I mean, Fine Gael hasn't resiled from its position on where things currently stand. Yet at the same time, they are prepared to go a step further. So it nearly is as if they've talked out, but they haven't taken to the pitch just yet.
And Drew Harris commenting again today on his comments last week on the questions about the Provisional Army Council and their role in relation to Sinn Féin.
Yeah, basically what the Garda Commissioner said, he was at a policing authority meeting and he said he stood over comments in which his assessment, which was also consistent with the PSNI, that the Army Council retains this overseeing role between both Sinn Féin and the Provisional IRA. Now, he didn't give any information or intelligence or assessment as to how he came at that decision. He said that it required no further implication. And one key point, I think, from his point of view, was that he denied that making that statement was in any way politically motivated. He rejected that outright and said he was doing what he should do, which is a Garda Commissioner and comment at certain times when needs must.
OK, we'll leave it there. Paul Cunningham, thank you for that update. Mark Ward, can I just put that to you, what Drew Harris said today in relation to his comments from last week and the Provisional Army Council and the oversight role. Do you accept that that's a fair analysis and that he was merely, you know, repeating what was on the record and what both policing bodies on the island accept now?
I don't accept that. What I do accept is that in 1998, in the Good Friday Agreement, Sinn Féin were asked to embrace the peace process. I mean, embrace the peace process. The IRA are not there. The IRA have gone away a long, long time ago. They're not on the table. They're not on the playing field anymore.
But in relation to the accusations that Drew Harris was politicising the issue and was intervening in a political way, do you accept that he was merely stating and answering a question that he was asked?
I feel he was answering a question, but it felt like he was politicising the situation as well at the same time.
You do, do you?
Yeah.
Okay, and just before we leave it, James, in relation to those talks now that we hear are going to take place, policy, exchange of policies with Fine Gael, is this speed dating for slow learners?
Well, Leo Varadkar seems to be maintaining his position that he wants to lead Fine Gael into opposition. Exploratory talks are continuing, and I think that's what's going to happen now with this policy day. But at the moment, it appears really Micheál Martin is the only person who's actually trying to get into government and become Taoiseach. And we'll keep pursuing that, so we will.
Okay, let's move on because I want to get on to our main topic. And it is one that featured on the doorsteps in that election campaign we've just had, and one that will have to be dealt with by any incoming government, and that is mental health services, and particularly the dearth of supports available to children and young people who suffer from mental health issues. If I can go to you first, Dr. Harry Barry, can we first talk about the different categories of people who rely or should be able to rely on our mental health services?
Yeah, I think one of the great difficulties is, I said in a talk in London last year, that we're all obsessed now with mental health. That's the buzzword of the moment. We're all terrified of the word mental illness. We don't even want to hear it. But what we all should be talking about is what's really at the heart of most of the difficulties in our country at the moment is the world of emotional distress or mental distress, which is a completely different animal altogether. And I think what's important that all of us will or have the potential to wander in and out of those different stages. Like, none of us are mentally ill all the time or mentally healthy all the time, but quite a number of us will definitely float in and out between mental health and emotional distress and maybe back into mental health. There will be a certain percentage of the population who will definitely verge into more serious mental health conditions. I mean, I certainly, as a GP, as a doctor, I would classify the serious mental health conditions as schizophrenia, severe bipolar disorder, severe treatment-resistant depression, you know, really significant depression, and possibly severe anorexia, maybe OCD you could throw in there. And they would be maybe the bread and butter, really, of the specialist teams. Do you know what I mean? That's really what they're there for, really, to look after those.
But in terms
of... there's a massive, massive amount of other issues out there which don't nicely fall into the world of mental illness, but definitely fall into the area of emotion distress. And that's what so many people are crying out looking for help for.
And you make an analogy with how cardiology was treated 40 years ago.
Yeah, there was a wonderful example of this when in physical medicine, where many, many years ago, a famous cardiologist came out and said, you know, I feel like somebody standing at the side of a river and I'm watching all these bodies floating by me and I'm jumping into the river and I'm pulling some of them out and I'm resuscitating some, but some are dead before I can get to them. And after a while, I began to think about, you know, really, where are these bodies coming from? So maybe if I went upstream and could find out where they're all going in and maybe try and stop some of them going in. And that was really the beginning of the whole world of secondary prevention and primary prevention and eventually now into the whole world of physical health. The difficulty is that mental health is about 30 years behind. We have now got to the point where cardiology is superb, do you know what I mean? And we're doing stents and doing all this wonderful thing. But physical health or mental health is way, way behind. So,
and we're still, what you're saying is we're still dealing at the meeting mental
still,
health.
We're still thinking of point. Mental health in terms of mental illness. You know, we're like the cardiologists. So I often give the analogy that what we really need to do is not just go upstream and find out where everybody's going in order to start finding out, get people earlier before they become seriously ill and maybe suicidal and all the rest. But I go a step further back, and I keep talking about this in schools and colleges and things like that. What we really need is to develop the skill to teach people how to swim. So if I could learn how to swim, if I did fall in, I have a far better chance of survival. So we have a massive job of work to do. We are so far behind in our understanding of mental health. You know what I mean? We have this very old-fashioned fixed view of mental health. And in my opinion, unless we start rethinking the whole, you know, and start breaking it up into its different components and try and and try and put the proper work in. We'll talk about possible ways of dealing with this later. But we have to look at mental illness, and we have to look at improving mental health and resilience, and we have to look at what do we do with this massive number of people in emotion distress. Those are the questions.
And you mentioned there, you know, getting people at the start point, but we now know that a lot of the population that presents with mental health issues, a lot of them are within younger people, like children and adolescents up into the mid-20s.
Well, we know the figures are really very obvious, and they're worldwide figures. You know, that 75% basically of significant mental health difficulties will occur under the age of 25. So by 25, three quarters of them have appeared. For example, I keep talking about depression and we're not listening, that 50% of all cases of first bouts of depression will occur between 15 and 25. 25% between 15 and 18, and another 25% between 18 and 25. So we have this very large volume, often missed, particularly the first group, you know, the early ones, the 15 to 18 are so often missed. And out of that then grows, you know, a kind of a history or a pattern of recurrent bouts of depression from then on. Because we know, again, that the better you treat the early bouts of depression, the better the outcome is for most people long term.
OK, so let's talk about how we do treat people who present with issues. June, you would have, as a medical journalist, have covered the launch of A Vision for Change 14 years ago now, which was, of course, the launch of care for mental health services at the time. Like, where did that go? Did it make an impact at the time? And are we still seeing the after effects of that?
Yeah, I mean, it was launched in 2006 and, 14 years ago. So when it was launched, Vision for Change was seen as a visionary document, and it had full party support. It was our national mental health policy. And it is an excellent document. It's still an excellent document. It speaks mainly about, you know, taking mental health services out of the acute sector and into the community. And when it started off, it was there was funding put behind it, and it got off to a very good start. And I thought what was very good about it was that every year there was a Vision for Change implementation policy committee who met, and they looked at all the recommendations and they gave their report that lasted for, I'm not sure, maybe 4 or 5, 6 years. This committee met, gave their annual report, and then they seemed to disappear. I don't know where they went to. And then next thing we see, you know, 14 years later, Mental Health Commission's report that came out earlier this month that showed that, you know, basically Vision for Change hasn't been implemented. And so much more needs to be done, and particularly around the use of acute beds. The report showed that there was an inappropriate use of acute beds. So basically that people were staying in acute beds for up to 6 months, and that's not what acute beds are made for. And there was a lack of supports in the community, such as long-term rehabilitation units, intensive care units, and particularly there was a real need around older people and units for older people. So what you had was people who were suffering an acute episode coming into a psychiatric hospital in an acute bed. But then when the acute episode is over, there was nowhere for them to go. So, and then more people
were in the queue behind them, basically waiting for it. Kieran Moore, people will remember you because you took a stand in relation to this. You were a consultant paediatric psychiatrist in the CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service in Wexford, for 16 years, I think, before you stepped down in 2018.
Yeah.
Remind people why you decided you had to step down.
I had to step down. I suppose I had spent, in my view, a lot of time trying to improve things. And I'm aware I'm one person, and I'm aware of my own views of things, and I'm aware I'm not perfect, God knows. But I really tried to look at how we could provide a better service to the patients or the children that were there. And it was very difficult from... You know, resources, yes, but I suppose it's the way we do things and the way that I suppose, including doctors, but including everybody, the way we do things, I think, is a problem. And I would agree with Harry. I think we have to look at the nomenclature of this very carefully, because mental health does cover a vast range. And I think we have to try and break it down a bit, because there, as you said, mental distress is huge, and the whole thing gets mixed up, and it's very hard to try and work out what avenue. And, you know, if you have chest pain nowadays, you have a fairly clear pathway as to what to go. If you have asthma, you have a very clear pathway. It's very unclear in mental health. And I suppose there's almost a reverse stigma in a way for those who actually are sick. And by that, I'm using that terminology in the more severe, like schizophrenia and kids and children, ADHD is a huge problem as well. So the trouble is that because we kind of medicalize human distress in a huge way, is that we don't look at what's underlying. And I'm agreeing with that in a sense. And there's a whole societal change, and I think we all have to take responsibility for this. Is that our children, as parents, and I'm one myself, we're not good at holding our children's distress anymore, let alone our own distress, and that anxiety, and you know, what children do when they're distressed now is very different to what they did 30 years ago. Things like self-harm and that are much more aware.
Why is that? Because that is something you would never have heard of. Even 15 years ago, it wouldn't be something that would be generally, we would have been generally aware of. But now, adolescents, children self-harming seems to be...
It's just much more expected. Available and... You know, to me, it's primarily that people understand that it's there, and an awful lot of children that I would see, you know, will be in distress. They'll get on, and I'm not blaming social media, but I mean certainly partly blaming social media. It's much easier to get on, and they'll ring a friend. They don't ring, but they'll contact a friend. I'm showing my age, and they will say, "Look, you know, I'm feeling yucky, I feel like, is life worth living?" And they'll say, "Well, look, you know, have you tried self-harming? Or I'll show you something that's online. I tried it, it worked." And it does work in the very short term for people. It distracts them. And I suppose, you know, that's the bigger bit is that how we manage when a child is so distressed that they self-harm, and we have to take it very seriously every single time. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they need to go to hospital, or it certainly doesn't necessarily mean that they need to see a psychiatrist or go into hospital. But what happens is that because, you know, and I think this is going back to primary care and your idea of teaching people to swim. For instance, if we ever manage to get, say, psychology or therapists into a GP practice, mm-hmm. to me that is the most sensible place, because you've got, you know, a GP is horrendously busy anyway. They have 7 minutes if you're lucky, and if we had somebody who was there, who was actually present with the patients, that's teaching people to swim. In that context.
Okay, we just got a text in here. "I'm so tired of the constant whinging from Irish people about the health service. My son has several health issues, and we moved back here from Australia last year. We were seen by a CAMHS within 5 weeks of referral and are receiving multidisciplinary team therapy, which is far better than what we received in Australia." That's a text from Gillian. That jars with what a lot of people would have been hearing about the CAM service and the difficulties with CAMHS. I mean, what was the situation in Wexford?
I actually was going to say that I'm aware myself, like I feel like I'm like a broken record. There is good work going on, and there's extremely good work going on, and there are children who are getting better, and that's why anybody does this job, because, you know, and I love it in that sense that you can help to make somebody better. And that person's absolutely right. There is a lot of good stuff going on. That's really important. But it behoves us still to make it better and to look at how I'm delighted that that's a good experience. But there are plenty of other different experiences as well. You're going back to Wexford to answer your question, because I haven't answered it. It was the way the system worked in terms of you know, as a consultant in this area, I have a modicum of expertise. So I knew what we needed. But there is no mechanism for me to source that resources in any sense, and that's difficult.
But didn't Vision for Change set out what a CAMHS team
should look like
in an area? What kind of numbers are you looking at in terms?
Well,
of
you know, to be clear, but it's a 12-person team for 50,000 gross population, which would be about 24,000 children under 18. But that did not exist anywhere in the country. It was more so in Dublin. You did get up to about 65-66%. And in the rural areas, like where we were, it was about at less than a third. And that's not all just resourcing. It's also about staff recruitment, staff retention, people in, you know, enjoying the work and that kind of stuff as well. But I suppose it was really about a mechanism of trying to be heard in the sense of this is what's needed, could we get some of it? And how, you know, and I don't mean just money, but how we might get another person. There was no mechanism of doing that. For instance, the managers, and I don't mean to just blame managers, but they only one of them ever came to see what we did. And I stand up and say, to me, that's a ludicrous situation where you have people managing, including the money, about a service they know nothing about. So we have to change that. That if you're managing something, come down and find out about it. Or that you have to have some kind of expertise to do that.
James Brown, this is your constituency, Wexford, and I know you've a personal reason. Before it became a big political issue, because it is a big political issue in Wexford, there's been big marches in Wexford in relation to these services, but you had a personal reason for taking an interest in this.
No, absolutely. Well, look, growing up in Enniscorthy with St. Senan's Mental Health Hospital there, you couldn't help but have, I suppose, an awareness of mental health issues. But shortly after I was elected to the Dáil, one of the Fianna Fáil councillors in Wexford, Councillor Fergie Keogh, took his own life. And I suppose for me, while always being aware of mental health issues, it was the first time, I suppose, really experiencing someone personal and close taking their own life, and the impact that had on family, on friends, and what Fergie himself must have been going through at the time. And then got to know Dr. Kieran Moore as well shortly after that. And look, there has been very real issues in various parts across the country. I think Wexford, South Wexford, Waterford has been particularly, badly hit in terms of lack of services and supports for the likes of Dr. Kieran Moore when he was there. And we've only just now, I think about 18 months later, had a new child psychiatrist appointed in Wexford.
18 months after
Dr. Moore left, and in fairness to Dr. Moore, he hung in there a very, very long time, and he was very, very popular and supported by the families down there. The mental health warriors have done fantastic work down there highlighting the issues. But you see such a nonsense, some of the nonsense that goes on. There was a new facility obtained by the HSC in Wexford Town 2.5 years ago. There's been €250,000 on rent paid on that new facility. The staff still haven't moved in. I mean, that kind
of... Nobody has been treated in that facility.
Nobody's been treated in that facility. And I actually think the lack of a new built environment, that facility, is one of the reasons it took so long to acquire or attract a new child psychiatrist, because the Saney House that's there is simply not fit for purpose. But I think one of the issues that's arising as well, we've loads of managers in the HSC, but we don't have child psychiatrist managers. So your kind of child psychiatrist seems to be trying to fight to get supports and attention off the broader mental health managers, who don't really seem to have any interest or any expertise in it. No new mental health leads either in the CHOs or at a national level. And recently we've seen the HSC actually downgraded mental health in terms of getting rid of the director of mental health off the HSC board. And I think that's had, as a clinical lead, and that's had an impact as well. So there's an awful lot of disjointed stuff going on there.
Yeah, you see, we're getting, this is the kind of text we're getting in now. Could you ask your guests why there is such an increase in anxiety in kids? My 7-year-old is suffering from worry, tummy pains, can't get to sleep. We're now seeking help with play therapy. It took 3 months to get a slot. That's from a Wexford texter, Joe. I'm suffering with a very serious mental illness like many others because of lack of resources. I've been left on a waiting list for too long. That's from a listener in Sligo. And another one, my 10-year-old kid hasn't been to school following an assault last October. Can't get a CAMHS appointment, no support from school. What do we do? Paying privately for lay therapist and psychologist. And I think that is an issue, isn't it? That a lot of people turn to private therapists and psychologists because the wait list is too long. Mark, I want to bring you into it because this is your background, isn't it? You're a
behavioural therapist.
A behavioural therapist. Mm. And you would have worked with Jigsaw in North.
No, I wouldn't have worked with Jigsaw. I would have worked with a lot of other community organisations, especially organisations specialised with people with addiction issues and trauma issues and behavioural therapy. Jigsaw was set up many years ago in Knockandalkin after a spate of youth suicides. A lot of people from the area, that they would have a big fear about this copycat kind of suicide that was going on. And we had a spate of them at the time. A lot of them were families and friends and children of these people that I knew personally. It was set up and it worked. Like, they had clinicians, they got appointments, mental health and suicidal thoughts, the stigma started breaking down, people were talking within each other, they learned new coping skills which weren't there before, which we're talking about early interventions and learning how to swim, which is really, really important. But just this year, the jigsaw service that was there has gone from a 5-day service, comprehensive service, to a 2-day, possibly satellite service that's going to look after North Dalkin due to funding and restructuring of jigsaw. And the people in North Dalkin are devastated by this, and the fear is rising back up again.
And of course, you can't get away from the fact that in areas where there is disadvantage and there's other social issues and maybe addiction issues, this is where you're going to see very serious mental health issues as well.
Without a doubt, as I said, I grew up and there was a lot of young lads that I grew up and played football with are no longer here today through suicide or through drugs or whatever it might have been. And that's what happens when you have areas like my own that were subjected to poverty. There was just houses built with nothing built around it. There was no infrastructure. There was no roads. There was no transport. There wasn't any schools even when we moved up there first. And that's why we're always talking about a lot of stuff that's causing mental stress and issues with mental health, and a lot of stuff that's causing right across the country lack of housing, lack of healthcare, lack of transport, lack of education, amenities, and they're all adding up. And if you start tackling them all together, it will have an impact on people's positive mental health.
Harry, can I just say, if I'm a parent, and I know you're saying, you know, we need to teach our kids resilience and we need to not panic when they...
We also need to teach or treat ourselves as well.
But if your child has a serious mental health distress, you know, anxiety issue that is really impacting on their life, and you are really seriously worried about what might happen, if I take my child to a GP, what are your options?
Well, the GP's options in general, he's encouraged most of the time to refer that child to the child psychology service, you know, because if he refers it to CAMHS very, very regularly, unless it belongs to one of the serious mental health conditions that I discussed. You see, anxiety in some senses is being given this monster name, do you know what I mean? In fact, anxiety is a very normal condition that lots and lots of people have. And it's actually, this is what frustrates me completely, is actually very, very treatable with very simple CBT kind of techniques. You can teach a child how to deal with panic attacks, how to deal with phobias, you know, with proper, simple CBT techniques. But what we actually do is we now medicalise the whole thing. You know, it now becomes the monster, you know. So the poor child becomes the problem. Instead of the child being part maybe of a house that might be very stressed and anxious anyway, the poor child is showing the symptoms. But if you have a child, say, who's significantly depressed, you know what I mean? Now we're moving into more serious country. If we have a child who's very actively suicidal, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, perhaps maybe some major emotional issues going on, maybe social media issues going on, maybe cyberbullying, all those kinds of issues.
I cannot imagine a more terrifying scenario as a parent.
That's the scenario that I'm most concerned about.
Because so what happens then?
Because what's going on is here, the GP is kind of stuck, really, because where does he refer them, really? You know, the child psychology service you make your appointment kind of, and if hopefully you're accepted, you know what I mean, you eventually get an appointment. Now, I think it's important, there is a primary care counselling service, which is in most GP practices now, but it's a very, very specific one. It doesn't deal very much with children. They only take certain fairly, you know, defined kind of areas. They'll only give 6 sessions, but they're certainly not appropriate for the kind of severe emotional stress kind of situation. So now you're in a situation where, what do you do? Do you send a child down to casualty? Do you know what I mean? Which is what's happening a lot of the time.
Is that what GPs
well,
are doing?
Well, what else can they do? They're stuck, do you know what I mean? They've nowhere else to send them. Whereas, you know, I spoke to the Joint Oireachtas Committee on the Future Mental Health, because I was brought in to ask about the whole world of psychotherapy. Do you know what I mean? Talk therapy. I mean, I use CBT kind of techniques myself, do you know what I mean, which are immensely... And I suggested that we should be considering in Ireland, the English have a very good system there, set up by a guy called Professor Clark in 2004. It's called the IAPT. It's the idea behind it is, it's kind of immediate access psychotherapy. You know, the idea being that
if I'm
very distressed, I'm a parent, or I can pick up the phone, I can ring, I can ring a central kind of agency that I would be listened to by a therapist, whatever the issues are. I will be seen and assessed within maybe 24 hours, and I will be assigned into whatever area. That kind of idea, I feel, a kind of a national free psychotherapy service. It's a free service. It's not, it's again, you know, how, like, what percent of the population have no money to spend on this kind of thing? It's all very well to say if you're fortunate enough to be able to go privately, but what do you do otherwise, you know?
Yeah, Kieran, you work in Crumlin now. The access to beds for not just young people, children, adolescents, but anyone presenting with serious suicide ideation. What are the options there now?
I suppose I'm just going to answer it slightly to one side and hopefully answer at the same time. I think what you're saying, again, is a very good idea, but I think we have to look at the spectrum. What people want is exactly what you said. If you're worried about your child, you want to talk to somebody now, not 5 weeks' time or 10 weeks' time. And we all know that going to A&E, or we all think going to A&E is not the right thing, but it happens all the time, all the time. And GPs, again, you know, are moidered with people coming in. They've nowhere to go. CAMHS, long waiting lists. Sometimes they don't see people unless there's particular areas. Community care psychology, 5-year waiting list in some areas. So what the hell do you do? So we are using A&E all the time, all over the country. It's local. It's you know, the paradigm at the moment is that when we admit people, and that's a small percentage, we send them off to Cork or Dublin when they live in Wexford or Galway or Donegal. Like, what are we doing? You take them away from the family, take away from school, and we send them off to a place with a different treating team for God knows how long, come back. So what we do, in my view, is that we look at the spectrum, that in the GP surgery from 9 to 5, something like that psychotherapy service, it'll be 9 to 5 or slightly longer than that. And then at night time, because that's when the major problem is, that we look at and recruiting weekends. And weekends, like that's the vast majority of the time, is that we actually equip A&Es with a separate part of it, and that we use the beds we're already using. The trouble is, we're not recording this because the Mental Health Commission doesn't record them, because it's not an approved centre, you know, the mental health, like the other psychiatric hospitals.
But presumably, if somebody turns up at an A&E at 2 in the morning in a severely distressed state, talking about suicide... Yes. They're going to see a junior doctor, possibly, that will, you know, will not have the kind of expertise.
But they'll usually admit,
or Harry
they will admit somebody until the following day when they can be seen. Or in some places there are people, consultants who are on call or have are psychiatry. And that's very, very rare. But
they will also, these people could end up on a trolley for a couple of days as
they
well,
could.
Presumably,
they
in that distressed state, in this in an environment they should not be in.
I agree. And they do. But they do anyway, because, you know, there is nothing else after hours.
How
there is
many
nothing
like
else.
When you
available.
Say, you know, they will be then sent on to, like, how many beds do we actually have for acute psychiatric? Do we have?
You see, we have no beds for acute psychiatry in children. There are no beds.
None at all?
No. I mean, there are these four units, they call them, as I said, one Cork, one Galway and two in Dublin. It is impossible to get in urgently. They won't see you urgently. And they have a long process, which is a referral process, and they often say no. And by the time they might say yes, the patient, in some cases, is better. You know, whereas a lot of children get admitted to paediatric hospitals. At any one time around this country now, there are children that have been admitted because they're suicidal. And it bizarrely, it's actually better than it might seem, because they get it. There's no stigma in the sense they're in with other kids who've got difficulties. There's a huge amount of caring from the paediatric nurses, and they usually stay in for a day or two so you can organise something else out in the community.
I just see a note here. According to CAMHS, there are 74 registered beds, and there is four. This is in four inpatient units in Galway, Cork, and Dublin. Is that the figure you're aware of?
Yeah.
Is that not for children then? No?
It is for children, but you know, it's very hard to get a child in, and certainly an emergency. I've never had a child admitted.
Yeah, James. Yeah,
and it's very rare for any more than about 50 of those beds even to be available in terms of actually having the staff in place. So very often 10, 20, 30 of those beds are actually simply shut down because the staff are not in place. And I've dealt with a good few children who've been trying to get emergency access to those beds at the
weekends.
And
do parents actually call you and say, I can't get into a...
They will, yeah, out of sheer desperation. And you would talk to the child psychiatrist and they're pulling their hair out, because for each of those units, they have to fill in a separate application And it's simply not going to be accepted to weekends anyway. So you end up getting back, waiting until Monday. And we had one case in Waterford recently where we had a child who also suffered from autism but had mental illness issues, was in the emergency department in Waterford, 24 hours on a chair, and I think it was 40 hours in total. Finally admitted into a unit in Dublin, but was told it was the first time anybody from Wexford Waterford had been admitted at the weekend into a unit in Dublin. So that's what you're kind of
that
talking
about. That is actually scandalous, and beyond scandalous, is it not? That is shocking.
And I keep coming back to this thing. I just don't believe, I totally agree that, you know, at the moment, the A&Es and all the rest of it are as good as it gets. But I still think it's a very inappropriate place for a person with emotional distress. You maybe
for everybody else in A&E.
With people with all kinds of problems. Maybe drunk people. Maybe people with drugs. Maybe it. And I know of some people who have gone in very emotional distress and just simply leave.
Yeah,
they just walk away.
June, you have your own story in relation to that this can come upon you. Anyone. At any stage of your life, out of nowhere. Tell us your own story.
Yeah, I mean, even just talking about the A&E stuff first, I mean, so in 2005, I suffered from an acute episode of depression and anxiety. And thinking back to it then, how I felt then, I couldn't imagine being in an A&E unit because it happened over a number of weeks where I basically shut down. So I stopped eating. I couldn't speak very well. I couldn't walk very well. It was the physical manifestations of the illness that really struck me afterwards. So I was 38 at the time and I just got sicker and sicker. I stopped eating. I was very hyper alert to noises. So I could imagine in a busy A&E unit, I wouldn't stay. I certainly wouldn't stay. It's, you know, you're on edge the whole time. So over a number of weeks, I just got sicker, stopped eating, lost a couple of stone. And in the end, I was referred to via my GP, who was wonderful, to a psychiatrist. I was lucky enough, I had private health insurance. I went to St Edmundsbury Hospital in Lucan, where I stayed for 12 weeks. I was under the care of the late, great Professor Anthony Clare, who basically saved my life with medication and also, you know, psychotherapy and treatment there. If I didn't have health insurance, I don't know what would have happened. I don't know if I'd be still here today. You know, it was very, very serious. So I was one of the lucky ones in that I had a very supportive family. I had an excellent GP. I had an excellent psychiatrist. And then after 12 weeks, I was also very lucky that I got back to work. I think getting back to work for me was very important, getting back into the routine. I think lots of people who maybe have suffered from a mental illness or serious mental illness to the point where they're hospitalised, when they come out again,
the world is different.
The world is very different. You're a different person. And the supports need to be put in place to get people back to work because, you know, just because you've been sick doesn't stop you being an excellent employee, you know. And I think employers need to recognise that as well, that, you know, that you're still the same person. You're still, you know, you've just been unwell.
And in terms of the stigma, like we talk a lot, I mean, there's all these campaigns now. It's OK not to feel OK and to talk it out and all of that. I mean, is there, do you think, is that stigma, has that lifted in terms of how people regard people who have had brushes with the mental health services?
I think it's lifted for things like depression. It's lifted for things like anxiety. I don't think it's lifted for severe and enduring mental illness, so things like schizophrenia, severe bipolar, anorexia. So we're great about talking about, and it's wonderful, don't get me wrong, you know, that we're more open talking about depression and anxiety, because severe depression, as I know myself, is so debilitating. But we don't talk about schizophrenia. We don't talk about the more serious illnesses. I think there's a fear around them because we don't understand them. So we've a long way to go talking about that.
And I'm not as sure that the shame part of depression and stigma is still not lurking around quite a lot. And just one other practical point for you, that we forget completely that when somebody has significant depression or bipolar or schizophrenia, but especially depression, which is so common, you know, that cognitively, 95% of people who have a significant amount of depression will struggle cognitively. We never recognise it. Yeah, that's your memory, your attention, your concentration, your focus. So when you go back to work, you're facing two major problems: shame, because you're wondering, what will people think of me, and my cognition, where I'm really struggling, because you may be struggling for months and months after, even when the boat.
And presumably confidence, yeah, if you've had that.
Yeah. I remember though when I was sick, I certainly couldn't read, and I used to love reading. Yes, I couldn't read a line, and then I couldn't like. And I remember about 4 or 5 weeks later, I managed to do the Irish Times crossword, and it was a great breakthrough.
Yeah.
So like, I was lucky that cognition came back relatively quickly.
Yeah.
But confidence was a big thing, yeah.
Mark, in terms of the people you've dealt with over the years, and as you talk there about people in your community, addiction and mental health, they really go hand in hand. And the difficulties in getting treated for both at the same time, because if you, there are a lot of services that will treat you if you are diagnosed with one of those issues, but not with both.
And that's a problem with comorbidity or dual diagnosis, as it's called. Like, you'll have addiction services that will be able to cope with people's addictions and the services that are there, but you cannot cope with acute mental health illness that come in on top of that. And the same with the mental health service. And it's often the argument, what comes first? Does the mental health issue come first, or does the addiction come first? Because what drugs and alcohol do, it gives the people the ability to self-soothe. It calms an anxious inner world that's going on inside them. And they learn that, as we spoke earlier on, as a coping mechanism, how to deal what's going on, but it only works for a certain amount of time. And after a while, what's left with people, they have this addiction now because they're using this coping mechanism, because of a drug or an alcohol, to deal with a mental health issue, and the mental health issue starts coming out, and it's more pronounced then because of the addiction on top of it, and they're falling through the gaps. There doesn't be much conversations between, now in fairness, the Gundalkin Drug and Alcohol Task Force have been trying to bridge the gap between the addiction service and the mental health service, but it's really, really difficult. And we're talking about 2006, the Drug Task Force's funding was cut in 2006, and it still hasn't been brought back up to decent levels. So in order for the task forces to do something new, something that they're doing already has to go out, and it's really, really difficult to pick which one goes out to deal with something else.
Indeed. OK, I'm going to take a break, but we will come back with more of this after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
I get it.
And you're welcome back. We're talking about mental health services with Dr. Kieran Moore, Dr. Harry Barry, Fine Gael's, or Fianna Fáil's, James Brown. I nearly put you into the wrong party there, James. Sinn Féin's Mark Ward and medical journalist June Shannon. And just getting back to, you mentioned it there earlier on, June, the that report that came out earlier this month from the Mental Health Commission. Like, really hard-hitting report, saying that 14 years on after Vision for Change, that there was almost a complete absence of community mental health services. Maybe I'll ask you this, Kieran. Now, the HSE has come back and said it provides a wide range of community mental health supports across the state. Nationally, there's a total of 111 general adult community teams and 32 psychiatry of later life teams. And the HSE said these teams support people who remain in their homes and in the community where possible, in line with Sláinte Care. What's your sense of the state of play out there now in terms of the vision for change, the vision in that document for what, where we would be now, and what the actual situation is?
You know, you don't need me to tell you that we're nowhere near Vision for Change, either from an ideological point of view or from an actual resources on the ground. You know, to the extent, like, it's what are we now? We're 14 years ahead from it, you know, so you don't believe particularly it's going to happen. On the ground, you know, again, I don't want to be resolutely negative. There is work going on. There are people trying. There are in adult, and I'm not an adult psychiatrist primarily, but, you know, there are resources and there are attempts to get things going, but it's still very much focused on the hospital system. And again, the trouble with that then is that with the closure of the older psychiatric hospitals, which are very large institutions, you have much smaller amount of beds in general hospitals, and the kind of care that happened where people were actually allowed to, it sounds awful, in some cases people were almost living there, but in some cases they were, and there was a lot of care, and that can't happen anymore. It's very much in and out and in and out. And then the resources out in the community aren't there. Like, even the idea of a day hospital in say in child or day care would be fantastic, because it's local. You know, even if somebody presents after hours, you've got something to go to the next day. But we don't have them. There's none in the country.
Yeah,
at the moment,
we're getting texts, and a lot of texts coming in from people who have, you know, this is directly impacting on them. Some places saying that CAMHS isn't bad in their area, but that it's just in the wrong place or offering the wrong type of service. And other people saying that there's services practically non-existent. Mm. And then, like, you get a glimpse into the situation some families find themselves in. We have one here. We have a family member suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, sexually obsessed, violent towards elderly parent, no place willing to take her, waiting list greater than 18 months, some system.
Yeah, we have no idea. So, like, in terms of what we're going to do about it, you know, I do think we need, okay, we have vision for change. It hasn't worked. So, you know, I don't want to endlessly go back and do yet another one. But we either do it properly or we do something else. But
and do we need to overhaul what we're doing?
We do need to. There, more money has come in, but it...
the figure I'm seeing is 6% of six, the
it's still, it's
budget,
still ridiculous,
but 10% is what is recommended.
Yes, so we're way, way down. So we need to put the money, but we also need to have, as I said, a spectrum of care. And I go back to the idea of, say, of asthma, where most of the time you go to your GP with an inhaler. If it's worse, you end up going to outpatients. If it's worse, you're admitted. But that the main bit would be out in the community.
How do we get
in
such
that?
A mess that we are this far down the line with so many, so much discussion, so many awareness?
So maybe, you know, let's try and change it. That's really, we can go on forever. But to change it, we need money and we need an actual plan.
Yeah, James, can politics change this?
Well, I certainly hope so. But I think the biggest issue in terms of changing is trying to change the mindset from a hospitalised model to a community care model. And one of the facts that came up in the Future of Mental Health Care Committee was that we spent, I think in 2017, $400 million on psychotropic drugs, but only $10 million on talk therapies. Mm. So that'll tell you where the priorities are going. Mm-hmm. It's a medicated model. It's a hospitalised model. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of situations where you end up with escalation, where someone, maybe a child has suffered a bereavement in the family, some sort of trauma. They need to go to the GP. They need counselling. Mm-hmm. Can't get that. Months later, they need a psychologist. Mm-hmm. They're not getting that. A year later, it's referred to CAMHS, long waiting list in CAMHS, and the next thing they're referred to ED. And I think Temple Street Children's Hospital had an interesting and a horrifying statistic that between 2006 and 2018, the number of children presenting at ED with mental illness increased eightfold in what, 12 years. I mean, they're not getting the care they need.
What is that though, Harry?
Well, I think there's no doubt. In the last book I did, Self-Acceptance, I actually very interesting looked at almost like the graph of mental health difficulties in children. I'm talking about adolescents now. Remember, adolescence is from 13 to 25. Mm-hmm. And I really want to stress that, because there's this nonsense going on. This is just going on to 18. There's carnage going on in our colleges. Mm-hmm. You just bring in somebody from your colleges here to talk to you about. But, you know, if we look at that group, that 13 to 25, I looked at there's a straight line graph between the rise of social media and mental health difficulties in our young people. It's almost like a parallel graph. So what's clearly, I'm not saying it's all due to social media, but clearly social media is playing a major part. And I think our young people, when I talk to them, are incredibly stressed from so many different areas. They're being forced to cope with all kinds of things that we didn't have to cope with, whether it's sexual identity, gender issues, relationship difficulties, social media. The kids are watching porn at 10, 11, 12 because the parents are giving them smartphones far too early. The girls are self-harming because boys are forcing themselves on girls, and they're self-harming as a coping mechanism. So, you know, the anxiety levels are rising, rising, rising. And, you know, to me, we have to somehow get in on the ground there and we get working with schools and parents to try to change ethos there. That's one.
Here's one text here. Could the panel discuss the possibility of a shared psychological service for a cluster of schools to deal with teenagers?
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. I don't care who does this, but...
I
would probably argue that we don't fully really understand the difference between a psychologist and a psychotherapist, and they are subtly different. You know, it's very expensive to train a psychologist. It takes a long period of time. They're very specific to do very specific things, and the child psychology service is very restricted because there's so few and they're very expensive. Now, if you take in the whole properly trained psychotherapist, I mean properly registered, properly trained and properly organised, and spread them around the country or group them properly around the country, whether you do it through GP practices, I don't care how you do it, but some system that allows the safety valve of that child you were talking about, why are they reaching the stage that they're so distressed, they're self-harming and they're down in ED? It would be far better if that child had a simple chat with somebody very early on, the problem was sorted out. And I know from talking to young people, often one or two chats with them resolves whatever the issues is, and some skills, teaching them. I think we should be teaching in schools. We should be teaching them how to deal with anxiety. It should be how to deal with all that kind of stuff.
We're getting a huge amount of texts in about people suffering with anxiety and trying to cope with anxiety. I just want to ask Mark, because you were out knocking on doors very recently.
Yeah.
What were the kind of issues were people raising with you in terms of these services and mental health issues?
Well, one of the issues that was coming up was around the housing crisis. We have a lot of people, especially around my area, that would be on council waiting lists or have been in homelessness and having to self-accommodate. And I've seen that myself with young families in my office for the whole day trying to find somewhere to stay for the night. And every time the parent makes a phone call to a hotel or a temporary accommodation and they're told there's no room in the inn, you can see the stress. You can see on the children, never mind the parents, but you can see on the children and the look of disappointment all the time. And that's one of the big figures. If you go into one of the homeless hubs, you will see children that do need the sort of interventions that we're talking about. And they need it now. They need it early, not in 10 years' time when it could be too late.
And obviously, you're going to be looking at these problems storing up for down the line as well. And what are we putting in place for that?
And these
Just one thing. When you listen to children, and it's interesting, I'd love to hear children talk on a radio show like this as well. But I was just asking one young lady who's been with us, and I said, "What do you need? What makes a difference?" And she said, "What's made a difference is somebody listened to me." And I'm not trying to descend into sentimentality just for the sake of it, but actually, it's incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's really what most people want is to be heard at the time they need to be heard at. And that's in adults and children. And really, that's fundamentally what we need to do is to really hear. And that depends on you yourself and the time of the day it is, etc. But if we're going to put in a system, we need to have somebody that's able to truly hear and listen to what the child has said, acknowledge it, and then try and do something about it. Not say we'll do it, not do it.
Yeah, June, you've been trying to get in there.
Yeah, no, it's just to say that those services, whether they be, psychology services, psychotherapy services, whatever they are, they need to be free at the point of access, because people don't have money. Yeah. We don't have out-of-pocket expenses. That's the problem.
And I think, have we any idea of how much money is being spent by parents in particular up and down the country on play therapy and psychology services and psychotherapy?
A counsellor can charge, it can up to between €1,800 an hour, because that's how much I've paid in the past. So you've got people who have, as you mentioned about people in homeless hubs, again, you've got a whole marginalised area of society that we haven't even touched on, like the homeless, refugee, people seeking refuge, who have a whole other area of difficulty accessing services. But, the thing is, people don't have money to pay for these services. And the reason why they can't get immediate access is because they can't pay for them. So they go on longer waiting lists and things get into crisis.
And let's a note of optimism in terms of, you've done a lot of work on perinatal depression.
Yes.
And there have been some good improvements in relation to that.
Yeah, perinatal mental health services. So it's just an area that I've got a special interest in. So there has been a huge improvement. There was so 3 years ago, we had our first national perinatal mental health strategy was launched. And prior to that, before the strategy, there was 3 perinatal psychiatrists working in the country. Mm. 3 of them were part-time and 3 of them were in Dublin. So you had no services outside of Dublin for women who were either pregnant, post-pregnancy, or maybe they were living with a severe mental illness and wanted advice about drugs, which were safe in pregnancy, etc. They had to come to Dublin, or whether they were liaising psychiatrists around the country that could help. So the perinatal mental health strategy was launched 3 years ago, and we now have a service in we have three full-time psychiatrists in Dublin now, perinatal consultants, and then we have one in Cork, one in Galway, one in Limerick. So we've got teams in the largest maternity units in these areas.
And I'm sure they're being kept busy.
Yeah, I'd say they are. Yeah, they're still not sure about the team in Galway isn't fully in place yet. So that's something I'm speaking to.
We've 30 seconds.
Yeah, what frustrates me enormously is the amount of money it would actually require to put in proper psychotherapy services around the country is peanuts compared to the amount of money we're spending when they get into big teams, into hospitals, all the rest of it. It's kind of back to common sense. Get there early. Stop it before it begins.
Are things getting better, Kieran?
I think slightly. but we need to do an awful lot more. It's better in the sense that people are aware of it, but otherwise...
Now the next thing is to start fixing it.
And we need data. We've no idea half the time what we're doing. We need data.
Okay, I'm going to have to take my last break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And we're almost out of time, just time for a couple of more texts. Adult mental health in Mayo has no psychologist and no dietitian. There is no direct support for eating disorders. Psychiatrist doing his best with no support services. That's from a patient, they say, suffering and struggling. And just one more there. CAMHS in Cork is quite good. The only issue is it's out in Blackrock and hard to get to. If you don't have a car, you also need to know which cages to rattle to get into the system. And that's all we have time for. I want to thank my panel for an excellent discussion. We could go on for another hour and we will hopefully have you back again. And thank you all for listening. Tonight's programme was produced by Regina Henley. Research was by A.B. Philbin-Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon and Nicky Dempsey was on sound. And I'll hand you over to Colm Murray on Late Date.